Shall we continue? Good. So now the next suttas we're going to have a look at, these are like a group of suttas coming together. These are all conversations between the Buddha and King Pasenadi of Kosalaha. And just to give you a little bit of background for those of you who are a little bit new to the suttas, King Pasenadi of Kosala, he was one of the great kings of ancient India. He was the king of a kingdom. Well, he was king of Kosala. That's why it's called King Pasenadi of Kosala. So he was the king of Kosala. And Kosala was a very large kingdom on the northern side of the river Ganges in India. It went down pretty much to Benares. Have many of you been to India? Here, yes? Quite a few of you? Okay. So if you go to India, you will have a rough idea where it is. When you travel in India, I don't know how you travel, by bus perhaps, and you travel between Savati, which is the capital of Kosala, you travel to Benares. It's quite a long distance, and all of that would have been part of this kingdom. And then moving all the way from Savati towards Kushinara, where the Buddha passed away, it's another long distance, all that too would be part of it. So it's probably in size maybe similar to Malaysia or something like that. It's hard to be very precise, but give you a rough idea. And he was the king of this country, and he was a very devout disciple of the Buddha. And there's a whole chapter of conversations between King Pasenadi and the Buddha. And this chapter is called the Kosala Sangyuta, in the connected discourses of the Buddha. And there's actually more than that, because there are suttas elsewhere as well. And these are very sweet suttas, and very King Kosala was a fairly simple man. He was a king, but he wasn't very kind of advanced in the Dhamma, just because he was a king. So he was quite simple. So the suttas are quite easy to understand and easy to relate to. It's as if the Buddha is talking to an ordinary person, and they are kind of enjoying a nice conversation together. And so I would recommend you to, I'm going to look at quite a few of those suttas, but if you want to read the rest of them, then they were nice little collection to read. And again, it's in the connected discourses of the Buddha, the third Sangyuta there. And if you can't find it, then please ask some of the more experienced members of the BGF, and they will be able to point out to you where to find these things. The Buddha's main monastery, which is called the Anathapindika's monastery, was just outside of Savate, would have been very close to where the king was. So the king could go anytime he wanted. He could go out and meet the Buddha. And of course, if you are a king, you get a bit of precedence, is that right? It's always like that, So I'm sure that even the Buddha would probably have given a bit of precedence to the king, perhaps, simply because you've got to be on good relations with the king, otherwise you're in trouble. It gets very, very hard otherwise. For that reason, they had a large number of conversations, very down to earth. And the very first sutta here gives you an idea of how down to earth these conversations actually were. This first sutta is called the Bucket Measure of Food. And it goes as follows. So this is just like an introduction to the life of the Buddha. This is to kind of give you a feeling for the Buddha in a very ordinary setting, what he was like as a man, one-on-one, if you like, people talking together. At Savati. Now, on that occasion, King Pasenadi of Kosala had eaten a bucket measure of rice and curries. I think the buckets in those days must have been quite small, otherwise it would be in serious trouble. Then, while still full, huffing and puffing, the king approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, and sat down to one side. Then the Blessed One, having understood that King Pasenadi was full and was huffing and puffing on that occasion, he recited this verse. When a man is always mindful, knowing moderation in the food he eats, his ailments then diminish. He ages slowly, guarding his life. So here you have the Buddha giving King Pasenadi a bit of advice on how to have a good diet. So It's interesting because we think of the Buddha as a very elevated spiritual teacher. He always talks about the Dhamma, he talks about the Buddhist path. But here he's giving very worldly advice, yeah, how to make sure you kind of don't gain too much weight, you don't eat too much, and you kind of live long as a consequence. It is very ordinary, and it's almost perhaps what you would expect, yeah? If you're dealing with a king and the king has a kind of ordinary problem, when you help with that as well. And this, in a sense, humanizes the Buddha, because it means that he was talking to people just like we talk to people. Yeah, and when there is a problem, you help them with whatever problem there is. As a monk, you know, when people come to you and they ask you questions, they will ask you about all kinds of things. All kinds of things that have nothing to do with monastic life necessarily, or Buddhism. And they expect you to come up with some wise understanding of everything. And sometimes you want to say, I don't know, I know the answer to this. But this is the thing. The Buddha usually he deals with these kind of issues just like we do today. He also dealt with those issues at that time, so here he tells him to be mindful. Yeah, you're mindful, and when you are mindful, then you know moderation in the food you eat. Why is that? And this already gives us a little bit of insight into the meaning of the word mindfulness. The Pali word here is sati. Sati mato means having mindfulness. And mindfulness is not just the idea of being present and observing, but mindfulness also is about knowing the teaching, knowing the Dhamma, knowing the instructions, if you like, at the same time. Those two things always have to come together with mindfulness. Very often we think of mindfulness just as the ability to be present. But if you don't have but mindfulness also means memory. You have a very good memory. If you really are present, you also are aware of whether what you're doing is right or not. In other words, you are kind of remembering the instructions. You remember what you're supposed to be doing. So if you are, whatever it is, if you are aware of kind of, you know, drinking nice apple juice. I'm going to do it just to show you. Okay. Easy to be aware. Yeah, very easy to be aware. Because you are aware, but you're not only are you aware, but you're also aware of what is suitable. How much apple juice do I actually need? Is that one sip enough? Yeah, one sip is enough. So you put it back again. This is like remembering the instructions, not to take things too far, but knowing the right amount. So mindfulness always has those two things coming together. And this is why we often talk about sati sampajanya. Awareness in itself is not really all that useful unless it is applied in a certain way. It understands the broader consequence of things. And this is what we're seeing here. Moderation in eating needs awareness, and also it needs the memory that actually I shouldn't be eating too much. And then you have this idea that his ailments diminish. Yeah, you get less sick if you eat the right amount, and you age slowly, guarding your life. That is kind of interesting, isn't it? Because I don't know, in the modern day, sometimes when I read things in the newspaper, they talk about modern diets, people fasting to live longer. Is that popular here in Malaysia as well? Yeah. So you fast in a few days, and then that will kind of extend your life and all these kind of things. Yeah, this happened already at the time of the Buddha. Already doing so, you live longer if you eat moderately. Yeah, maybe if you fast, it's even better. So we think that is kind of a modern invention. Yeah, it has been shown, and it has been shown by modern science that if you eat less, then actually it extends your life. But sometimes these ancient people, they had just the same insight we have today. They didn't need kind of all the scientific experiments and all that. They already had these insights. And very often, all we do with modern science is that we kind of reestablish insights and understandings that already existed from ancient times. Because some of these are just common sense, and you can feel it. And sometimes science is still behind the times and trying to catch up with the insight of people like the Buddha. So that is fascinating. That is all also in there. Anyway, so what happens next is this. Now, on that occasion, the Brahmin youth, Sudassana means beautiful. Yeah, he was a beautiful Brahmin youth. Sudassana means good to see, quite literally here, was standing behind King Pasenadi of Kosala. The king then addressed him thus, Come now, dear Sudarsana, learn this verse from the Blessed One and recite it to me whenever I'm taking my meal. Yeah, so if you want to get on a diet, then you get your husband or wife to recite this verse to you every time you're eating here. That's a nice idea, isn't it? Is that good? That's an interesting one. Or maybe you, yeah. So, anyway, that's one possibility. There are other ways. Maybe you can have a little card there with this verse sitting next to your seat, yeah? And you can, this is the Buddha's, remember this is the Buddha's advice on how to be slim, yeah? So it must be special. It's a special one. And then you should put this advice on your table next to your plate, and then you write from the Buddha underneath. And whoa, okay, I better be careful. Yeah? This is about faith and confidence in the Buddha. So try it out. See if that works. If you want to lose a bit of weight, yeah? And actually, I could do with losing a bit of weight myself, maybe. So maybe I should do that myself. It's a good idea. And then the Buddha says, I will then present you daily with 100 kahapanas as a perpetual grant. So this is how the Brahmins made their living in those days. They will say, whisper little verses into the king's ear, and then the king would give him lots of money as a consequence. So this is how you... Just like today, yeah, the king has a big court and the court kind of does various things for you. It was the same in those days. Kahapana is the monetary unit of that day. Another monetary unit of that day is the pada. The pada, and the pada has become baht in Thai. That's why Thai currency is called baht, because it comes from the suttas. It was a pada in the suttas. Yes, sire, the Brahmin youth Sudarsana replied, having learned this verse from the Blessed One, whenever King Pasenadi was taking his meal, the Brahmin youth Sudarsana recited, when a man is always mindful, knowing moderation in the food he eats, his ailments, his sicknesses diminish, he ages slowly, guarding his life. And then King Pasenadi gradually reduced his intake of food, to at most a pint pot measure of boiled rice. Okay. At a later time, when his body had become quite slim, King Pasenadi, of course, thus stroked his limbs with his hands. And on that occasion, uttered this inspired utterance. The Blessed One showed compassion towards me in regard to both kinds of good, the good pertaining to the present life and that pertaining to future life. So, it's quite sweet, isn't it? This is the king, and now he's so happy, kind of stroking his limbs. And and he has regained his, because of the Buddha, has shown compassion towards him. So, here the Buddha, he says that both in regard to the present life and also regard to the future life. Of course, there's nothing really in the sutta about the future life, but we will see that later on, that the Buddha often gives instruction where he divides up benefits as benefits in the present life and benefits in the future life. And elsewhere, the Buddha does teach King Pasenadi about the future life as well, although not in this particular sutta. So, there you are. That is just to kind of get you started. Yeah, this is kind of a nice, not the typical sutta that you will hear about the Buddha, but quite a nice little one. So let's just move on to the next one, because time always goes too quickly on these retreats. Suddenly, before you know it, bang, time is up. And then the next one is called Daughter. Again at Savadi. Then King Pasenadi of Kosala approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, and sat down to one side. Then a certain man approached King Pasenadi and informed him in a whisper, Sire, Queen Malika has given birth to a daughter. When this was said, King Pasenadi was displeased. Then the Blessed One, having understood that the King Pasenadi was displeased, on that occasion he recited these verses. But before I say the verses, just again, here you have the king, as usual, approaching the Buddha. He does this again and again and again. I don't know, maybe the Buddha thought he was a little bit of a pest or something after a while. I'm not sure. Oh no, the king is coming again. No, it's a dangerous thought when the king is coming. And then while he is there, a man comes to inform him. Yeah, Queen Malika. Queen Malika was his main queen. And there's a nice story about how she became his queen somewhere. I can't remember all the details now. But she was his main queen. And she was a very intelligent and very astute and very wise queen. And she, it seems that she was the one who actually made the king become a Buddhist. She is the one who got him interested in the teaching of the Buddha. And she was very astute in how she went about that. So she was wise. She probably was wiser than the king, actually, because she was the one who started out with this. But now she has given birth, yeah, and because she was his main queen, then of course the son or the child that comes from that marriage will be the most likely the heir to the throne, or the heir to the kingship. And that's why it is very important to get a son, yeah, because the son has to become the king. What about if you get a daughter? It's problematic. And in ancient India, daughters were not as popular as sons. And this is very kind of very common around the world, that sons were always preferred, yeah, to daughters. And very unfair, very unreasonable perhaps, especially from a modern perspective. Why is this the case? And now comes the nice thing about how the Buddha replies to this. Yeah, and some people have said that the Buddha was the first feminist because of how he replied. I'm not sure if that is a slight exaggeration, but anyway, this is what the Buddha says. A woman, O Lord of the people, may turn out better than a man. She may be wise and virtuous, a devoted wife, revering her mother-in-law. The son to whom she gives birth may become a hero, O Lord of the land. The son of such a blessed woman may even rule the realm. So the first verse there is perhaps better than the second one. The first one, where he says that, you know, a woman may be just as good or even better than a man. You cannot really judge by gender who is going to be good, especially from a Dhamma perspective, where what matters is your personality, the qualities of your heart is what matters. Then, of course, you cannot really make this kind of judgment. So from there, you can argue that the Buddha, in a sense, is more for gender equality. And it fits in with his ideas ordaining bhikkhunis as well, yeah, and giving bhikkhunis roughly the same status. They may not have had exactly the same status, and that is another question that is up for debate, to what extent they had the same status or not. But roughly the same status as the monks, and really being an independent sangha on their own. And from that you can argue that the Buddha was a little bit of a feminist in the sense that he wanted to give women roughly the same opportunities as he wanted to give the men. And that is really the meaning of feminism, as far as I'm concerned, is just the idea of giving women equal opportunities, which I think most reasonable people would agree with probably. Yeah, why shouldn't they? It doesn't seem fair otherwise. But then the last verse there is a little bit more coming back to how men always were more important because they were the ones who would rule, yeah? So a good woman was one who actually gave birth to someone who became the lord later on or the ruler later on. But still, it is a nice little verse. Not many things like that in the suttas which give this kind of feeling. So I picked that one out precisely because of the special sentiment that is found there. Very unusual for ancient India. India is one of the societies where the difference between men and women is quite significant. Let's go on to the next one. This is one more with Malika being the chief queen of King Pasenadi. So again, at Savati. Now, on that occasion, King Pasenadi of Kosala had gone together with Queen Malika to the upper terrace of the palace. Actually, palace is wrong. It means a stilt house. So the upper terrace of a stilt house. The good houses in those days were built on stilts so as to avoid animals and insects and floods and all that kind of stuff. So that is really the meaning of that Pali word. Then King Pasenadi of Kosala said to Queen Malika, "Is there, Malika, anyone more dear to you than yourself?" This is an interesting question. Is there anyone more dear to you than yourself? And when you are married to a king, you have to be a little bit careful, yeah, what you say to these kind of questions. Otherwise, if you don't say, "Oh, actually, king, I love you the most of all," then, you know, who knows what the king might do. So, yeah. Anyway, but she replies, she is honest, and that's obviously one of the reasons why she was wise. She says, "There is no one, great king, more dear to me than myself." And then she replies to the king, "But is there anyone, great king, more dear to you than yourself?" And the king replies, "For me too, Malika, there is no one more dear than myself." It's kind of an interesting sentiment, isn't it? It's quite different from what you often hear in other religions, where you are told that to love others kind of first and then kind of make yourself second and look after other people first. In Buddhism, it is kind of taken for granted that we all love ourselves the most. It kind of makes, and actually it makes very good sense when you think about it. If you're going to be able to love other people, how can you love others if you don't like yourself? It's impossible. You have to like yourself first of all. And liking yourself doesn't mean that you become completely self-obsessed and stupid and, have some kind of psychological disorder or anything like that. That is not the point. It just means that you have a healthy self-regard, a healthy feel good about yourself. You don't put yourself down or diminish yourself or, make your life, make yourself miserable. And this is one of the reasons why in the suttas the Buddha says that if you are going to choose between looking after yourself by practicing the Dhamma or teaching others, practicing for yourself comes first, because you are closest to yourself. That is where you can make real impact, is when you look at yourself rather than other people. It's difficult enough to teach ourselves and practice ourselves, much more difficult to teach others. So you deal with yourself first. Anyway, then King Pasena of Kosala descended from that stilt house and approached the Blessed One. Having approached, he paid homage to the Blessed One. In other words, you bow down to the Blessed One, you sit down, and he related to the Blessed One his conversation with Queen Malika. Then the Blessed One, having understood the meaning of this, on that occasion uttered or recited this verse. Having traversed all quarters with the mind, one finds no one anywhere dearer than oneself. Likewise, each person holds themselves most dear. Hence, one who loves themselves should not harm others. So again, the Buddha confirms what the king has just said, but with a nice little twist on the end there, and that twist is what makes it a real Buddhist teaching. So, because you love yourself the most, you should not harm other people. Yeah, and it's obvious, because if you know that each one of us loves ourselves most, if I harm you, I harm someone who loves themselves. And then, you know, I know I cause you to suffer, and I give you a hard time. So if you really like yourself, and you understand that other people are just like you, then you are kind to others as a consequence, because, you know, they want to be happy. So every time you do something kind towards someone else, you are helping them in that self-love. You're giving them something they want. You're giving them something they desire. You're giving them a gift. Remember that. Every time you do an act of kindness to somebody, you say something kind, you have a kind thought, you do an action or whatever it is, you're giving a gift to the people around you. And this is a very beautiful way of thinking about how we interact with the world around us. And then, because you do that, loving yourself leads to loving of others. And then we come to another sutta, which is very closely related to that. Just coming next here. And this is also called Deer. Atsavati. Sitting to one side, King Pasenadi of Kosala said to the Blessed One, "Hear, Venerable Sir, while I was alone in seclusion, a reflection arose in my mind thus. Who now treats themselves as dear, and who treats themselves as an enemy, as a foe, an enemy?" "Then, Venerable Sir, it occurred to me, those who engage in misconduct by body, speech, and mind treat themselves as an enemy. Even though they may say, we regard ourselves as dear, still they treat themselves as an enemy. For what reason? Because of their own accord, they act towards themselves in the same way as a foe might act towards a foe. Therefore, they treat themselves as an enemy. Yeah, but the point here is that I don't know if it is immediate. It may be immediate, obvious for some of you. But the point here, of course, is that how does an enemy treat an enemy? You want to hurt your enemy. Yeah, that's what enemies do to each other. They kill each other, they maim each other, they hurt each other. That's the reality of warfare and all of these kind of things. But if you act with misconduct by body, speech and mind, you have to reap the consequences of that. You will hurt in the future. Every time you do a bad action towards someone else, you're hurting yourself. You're acting towards yourself as an enemy because you're creating suffering for yourself in the future. So remember that when you feel like, you know, you are not in a good state of mind and you want to say something a little bit harsh perhaps, or act in a way that isn't 100% nice, remember that who you are hurting is yourself. Yeah, you are creating bad karma in a sense, and you know that the result of that in the future will be pain for yourself. You are your own enemy every time you act from anger, every time you act from delusion or even desire. So it's very, especially anger. Desire is not such a bad thing according to Buddhism. Anger is far worse. So be very careful with that anger and upset, because that is where we create so much havoc and we are treating ourselves as our own enemies. It's a very useful perception, because usually we think that we are hurting the other person. Actually, the person we're hurting the most is ourselves. But those who engage in good conduct by body, speech and mind treat themselves as dear. Even though they may say, we regard ourselves as an enemy, still they treat themselves as dear. For what reason? Because of their own accord, they act towards themselves in the same way that a dear person might act towards one who is dear. Therefore, they treat themselves as dear. When you act with kindness to someone, you are creating happiness for yourself. Yeah, you are treating yourself as dear as a consequence. And the Buddha replies, so it is, great king, so it is. It is nice to kind of see the Dhamma from many different angles. Yeah, and we know that we're supposed to be kind, but sometimes there are certain angles that make the Dhamma sink in a deeper way. We see a new angle of it, and this is a very simple teaching. But actually, if it makes you become a more kind person, then it has succeeded in doing something very useful. Sometimes the simple teachings are the best ones, because the simple teachings are things we can relate to, things we can use in our daily life to actually improve the quality of our life. And of course, being kind, and here is a very profound thing, it talks about by body, speech and mind. Yeah, even if you get a bit angry, even if you keep it to yourself, still, it is not ideal. It is not terribly bad if you don't act it out, but ideally you avoid getting angry altogether. That is also included in this. Okay, let us move on to the next one. More from King Pasenadi. I hope you're enjoying these little suttas, because I actually enjoy them. I think they're really, really cool little suttas. So that's why I've brought them here. Next one is called Archery. And this is one I have actually read out here before, I think. At Savati, sitting to one side, King Pasenadi of Kosala said to the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, where should a gift be given? Yeah, very good question, isn't it? Where should a gift be given? It's one of those things that people often we take for granted, that we should always give to a Buddhist cause, for example. We should always give to the Arahants. Is that right? Should we give to Arahants? We should not give it to Arahants. Yeah, you should. Yeah, maybe. Yeah. But that's not what the Buddha replies. He doesn't say, yeah, give it to the Arahants. Why doesn't he say that? Well, first of all, you don't know who the Arahants are. Yeah, how do you know who's an Arahant? Everybody says, my teacher is an Arahant. So everybody thinks their teacher is an Arahant. If you ask me about Ajahn Brahm, I will praise Ajahn Brahm to you. That is because I'm the disciple. Yeah. disciple always praises their teacher. Oh, my teacher, oh, so wonderful. I actually happen to think Ajahn Brahm is a very wonderful monk, and you can make up your own mind about that. But everyone praises their own teacher. And whenever you go to a monastery, you ask the disciples, they will say, oh, yeah, the abbot, oh, arahant, yeah. And sometimes you think, no way that this abbot is an arahant. Absolutely no way. So sometimes you have to be a little bit critical about these things. It can be very, very hard to know who is an arahant. And the reason why it is so hard is because the way most people live is so different from the way an arahant lives. When you are immersed in the worldly things, your ability to see someone who has a completely different mind state, a completely different way of living, and being able to understand that actually is very difficult. So you have to approximate, yeah? The Buddha doesn't say, give to the arahants. He doesn't say, give to the Sangha. It would have been strange if the Buddha said, yeah, give to me, yeah, give to the Sangha. It wouldn't sound like the Buddha. It would sound really, it would feel, oh, okay, not sure about this one. You would kind of feel kind of dodgy about that one. So the Buddha answers in a very beautiful way. He says, wherever your mind has confidence, great king, that is where you should give. The Pali word here is pasidati. Pasidati means where your mind settles down, where it has confidence, where you feel inspired. It has all of these kind of meanings. That is where you should give. So remember that in your daily life. Yeah, when you feel you want to give somewhere, ask yourself where you feel like giving. Where it comes natural, where you feel compassion. It doesn't have to be to a Buddhist cause, it can be to anyone. Yeah, it can be to poor people. There are lots of poor people around in the world, everywhere. When you feel that some poor person needs some support, and you kind of your heart opens up to that poor person, when you feel your heart opening up, that's when you feel inspired. That's when you feel compassion. That is the right time to give. And one of the reasons for that, why this is the right time to give, is because when you feel inspired, very often mindfulness comes along with that. Yeah, you feel inspired, you feel happy, you feel joyful, mindfulness is strong. Because you feel joyful and you have strong mindfulness, it leaves a powerful impact on the mind. And it will be easy to remember that act of kindness later on. And when you remember it, it will give joy for years in the future. Sometimes you do an act of kindness, you feel really joyful about it, and then you remember it in the future. And you can use that in your chaganusati, yeah, in your meditation practice, to bring back these experiences from the past, to give you a degree of joy in the present moment, just by remembering what you did in the past. The more powerful your mindfulness is at the time, the greater the impact that action will have, and the easier it will be to remember in the future. And this is one of the reasons why this is so powerful. And it teaches you something about the power of generosity. Yeah, you learn that generosity is something beautiful. You learn that the first person to benefit from your generosity is not the other person, it's you. Yeah, you do it. We do it in large part. You don't do it for yourself in an egotistical way. Yeah, this is for me. I'm going to get something out of this. Please don't think like that, because then you destroy the generosity completely. But know that you actually are a beneficiary of the kindness. So never look down upon the other person. Yeah, I'm going to give to you, you beggar. Yeah, you. Never think like that. Instead, thank the beggar. Thank the beggar. Oh, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to give to you. Have you ever done that before? Give to the beggar and say, oh, thank you so much for... I'm a beggar, yeah? So you can... no. Any beggar, and then thank them afterwards for giving you the opportunity to give to them and see what they say. They'll probably become shocked if that happens. But it happens sometimes in monastic life. In a few years ago, Ajahn Brahm told, we had a Cambodian monk staying at our monastery, and he was very helpful, and they were always helping out. They were helping out with the building work and very keen to help out. And then Ajahn Brahm said to him, oh, thank you so much for helping out with all the building work. And he replied, oh no, thank you for allowing me, for giving the opportunity to help out. Yeah, that is the right attitude, because it's like you know the power of generosity, you know the power of helping out, you know the power of good karma, you know you are given an opportunity to do something beautiful. So I should thank all of you. Thank you for inviting me. Yeah, give me opportunity to share the Dhamma with all of you. And it's true, because if I teach in the right way, it will give me happiness that I can share this beautiful, marvelous teaching with other people. Yeah, and then I should thank you. Thank you so much, Bobby, for inviting me here. And see what comes of this. So this is the right attitude, yeah? And it's kind of so different from the worldly attitude. It's just a different way of looking at these things. This is why this is actually quite interesting here. But then comes another question. And this is where the king says, but venerable sir, where does what is given become of great fruit? In other words, where is there most merit? Yeah, where do I get the most in return? And that is a different one from the previous one here, which is kind of interesting here, because that makes you wonder, well, where should I give it? Should I give where it's most merit, or should I give where it is best to give? What actually is best? And the point is that if we become too materialistic about giving, the Buddha says afterwards that, well, you know, to giving to an arahant basically is the best place to give. But if we become too materialistic about it, if we make a calculation about where we should give, yeah, arahants, they are the best, okay, let me scout out all the arahants in the world and I will give only there. If we become calculating like that, we destroy some of the spontaneity, some of the beauty of the act of generosity, and we lose some of that joy that comes with it. And if we lose the joy, the kamma is not as strong. Yeah? So it looks like these things are contradictory, but actually they're not. Yeah? And as you learn about Buddhism, as you incline towards Buddhism, you will want to give to Buddhist causes anyway. It will just be natural. But instead of narrowly focusing on Buddhist causes, you open up your heart, you open up your mind, and you kind of look at the world. The whole world is a field of merit. The whole world is a possibility to do acts of kindness and generosity. Take that opportunity, and then you're doing it in the right way. And in this way, yeah, there's almost no end to the possibilities of generosity in the world. There are so many chances in daily life where we can do little things, yeah, little things for the people around us. Generosity does not mean large things. Often it means small little things, again and again and again. Yeah, things like giving me a cup of juice. I'm coming back to this juice all the time. This is a small act of generosity, yeah? Someone is filling this up for me here all the time. What a wonderful thing that is. So I always have that is already kindness. And one of the nice things, the beautiful things about being a monastic or being a monk is that you become like the field for so many people's kindness and generosity. One of those astonishing things. All I have to do is live in the monastery. So we do in Perth, I just stay in the monastery, and every day 50 people come just to feed us. Yeah, I think, wow, this is astonishing. So you actually get to feel so much kindness from the people around you. This is one of the marvelous things. You really notice that as a monk, even more than you do as a layperson, because this is how the Buddhist tradition works. And it's very beautiful. So because of that, I'm going to have another sip of apple juice. Okay, so let us see what the Buddha replies, just to kind of get that out, just read it properly. And he replies, this is one question, great king, where should a gift be given? This is another, where does what is given become of great fruit? Yeah, so these are not the same answer, these are different things, and you need to separate those things out, which is very interesting here. And it shows us we should not be too greedy about this idea of merit, because it destroys the whole thing. What is given to one who is virtuous, great king, is of great fruit, not what is given to an immoral person. And then it goes on and goes all the way up to the arahant, and saying the arahant is kind of the highest field, and of course the sangha being even greater beyond that, and etc., etc. So there you are, and this is one reason why it is better to support humans than to support animals as well, because humans tend to be more developed than animals. No, I'm not going to say anything stupid in that context. Okay, so that is the little sutta on archery, yeah, touching on the idea of generosity, which is such an important part of the Buddhist path, and a lot of things could be said about that, but let's leave it at that. Okay, now, next one is called Grandmother. At Savati, then, in the middle of the day, King Pasenadi of Kosala approached the Blessed One. The Blessed One said to him, as he was sitting to one side, where are you coming from, great king, in the middle of the day? You're not supposed to come in the middle of the day. Yeah, this is kind of the subtext here. Yeah, the middle of the day is a strange time to come to the monastery. Something must have happened. Venerable sir, my grandmother has died. She was old, aged, burdened with years, advanced in life, come to the last age, 120 years from birth. Venerable sir, my grandmother was dear and beloved to me. If, venerable sir, by means of the elephant gem, I could have redeemed her from death, I would have given away even the elephant gem, so that she would not have died. If by means of the horse gem I could have redeemed her from death, if by means of a prize village I could have redeemed her from death, if by means of the country I could have redeemed her from death, I would have given away even the country so that she would not have died. So this is very sweet again. This is the king and his grandmother. He must have been a very young king because he still had a grandmother. So as very often is the case, grandchildren and grandparents often have a very close connection. Yeah, there was this joke I read somewhere that one of the reasons why grandchildren and grandparents are so close because they have a common enemy. Yeah. It's a terrible, terrible joke. But anyway, I read it somewhere. So that's why I could become a monk, because I had a sister and a brother who looked after the grandchildren part of things, and so my parents weren't so upset when I became a monk. This is one of the tricks to always have a brother and sister is always very useful. So, but again, here the king is, and he has all these. He would do anything, yeah, to redeem his grandmother. Death is always problematic. Death is such a big thing in human life, and it's something that we are never ready for. And we would often be willing to give up almost anything if only we could avoid dying. Here he says giving up his country. Yeah, that means giving up everything, because he's the king. Basically means giving up everything so that he could have his grandmother back. And then the Buddha replies, all beings, great king, are subject to death, terminate in death, cannot escape death. And then the king replies, it is wonderful, venerable sir, it is amazing how well this has been stated by the Blessed One. All beings, great king, are subject to death, terminate in death, and cannot escape death. And this, again, it just shows you the importance of the death contemplation in Buddhism. The reminder that everyone has to die. We have no choice in this matter. It's going to happen to us sooner or later, or usually much sooner than we anticipate. This is part of the problem. One of the things I noticed, I just mentioned before, that I went to a funeral ceremony a few days ago in Perth. And one of the things that person said is that it happened so fast. It happened so suddenly. And I've heard this before. People very often say that when someone dies, it always happens too fast. It always happens too suddenly. We are never really ready for death. And this is part of the problem. But actually, it doesn't happen too fast. It doesn't happen too suddenly. It just happens when it happens. Yeah, this is part of the problem. We're never really prepared for these things. So be prepared. When someone dies, you just say, oh yeah, I expected that. Makes you sound really cold-hearted, doesn't it? But really, it is the right way of looking at it. Yeah, we should expect these things to happen. And when you expect these things to happen, it changes your attitude to the people around you. It changes because you know that if this is the last time that I see Bobby, the last time I see you now, I will be kind to you, because I cannot afford to be an enemy with someone when I see them for the last time. Yeah? How can you can't die with enemies. You want to die when you have a good relationship with anyone. So if you remember that this could be the last time you see people around you, you always tend to treat people with kindness, because you don't want to die after having an argument, after having treated someone badly. So death contemplation is extraordinarily powerful. And this is why the Buddha makes a lot of this in the suttas, and that is why the king here, yeah, even though the Buddha is stating something obvious, he says, oh, it is wonderful and marvelous that you're putting it in this way, because of course this is true. We all know it's true, but we all also tend to forget it from time to time. Actually, we forget it a lot. The Buddha replies, "So it is, great king, so it is. All beings, great king, are subject to death, terminate in death, cannot escape death. Just as all the potter's vessels, whether unbaked or baked, are subject to break up, terminate in the breakup, cannot escape the breakup. So all beings are subject to death, terminate in death, cannot escape death." All, everything in the world crumbles and falls apart. Just as I was reading that, it occurred to me that there's a famous simile that you may have heard that Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Brahm's teacher in Thailand, that he uses, and he may have got, perhaps he got it from here, I'm not sure, but he has a famous simile of the glass, yeah? Ajahn Chah holds up a glass to all the monks. Not a cup like this, but a glass, a transparent glass, and he says to the monks, "Can you see the crack in the glass?" Yeah, and the monks look, no, there's no crack there. And then Ajahn Chah said, "Well, this glass is fragile. One day it will fall off somewhere or something, and it will split into 1,000 pieces. It is as if the crack is already there. The fragility is baked into the glass." Very similar to the simile of the potter here, yeah? One day it will crack, and because of that, that is why we care for the glass. Human life is just like that. It is a fragile, just in the same way as a glass is. One day we will all fall down, we will crack, and then we will be dead before most people are ready for it. It's a beautiful simile, and Ajahn Chah used it, and maybe he got it from here, because he may have read some suttas. He was not famous for having read many suttas, but he did study a little bit. And he said he read the Visuddhimagga. He got a headache when he read the Visuddhimagga, apparently. And Ajahn Chah was actually very, very, he didn't have much education, but he was very intelligent. He gave up on the Visuddhimagga. Perhaps that simile is in the Visuddhimagga. Maybe he has a, I'm not sure. Anyway, so that is the little thing about death. And we can continue about death, because the next sutta is also about death. We will continue about that this afternoon. But now I have to end. It's already 11:30 and lunch is coming up, yeah? Important business to look after. So so let's have a nice lunch. Have a nice lunch, everyone. And we'll see you back here again at, what time is it? 1:30 is the next sutta session. See you back again at 1:30.